The following episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast deals with serious and sensitive topics. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to Lyrics of Their Life, The Story Behind, the podcast where we uncover the true stories behind the songs you know and love. I'm your host, Adam Hampton, and in this episode, we're exploring the story behind the groundbreaking hit song, Billie Jean, by the king of pop himself, Michael Jackson. Peaking at number one on the Daily Global Spotify chart just this past week of May 2026, with over 6 million streams in one day thanks to the box office smash hit biopic, Michael, Billie Jean has seen a massive resurgence in popularity. But long before today, around 43 years since its release, Billie Jean was one of several classic singles that helped catapult the album Thriller into the record books for highest-selling album of all time. In this episode, we go behind the scenes to discover how Billie Jean was created, how it performed commercially, the monumental moment that Billie Jean became the first music video by an African-American artist to be played on MTV, breaking down the colour barrier forever, and that fateful night at Motown 25, where during a performance of Billie Jean, Michael Jackson would immortalize himself with the debut of his iconic moonwalk, as it would go down as one of the biggest moments in music history. Then, we take a deep look into the darker side of the track, the real-life paranoias, the terrifying stalking incidents, and the courtroom drama that completely shook Michael's world. So let's take a closer look at the story behind the song. This is The Story of Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. This is Lyrics of Their Life.
Prince has died at the age of 57.
This is it.
Sorry, Gary, but I was always the talented member of the band.
Keep booing, little girl. I will hit a man with glasses.
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York.
Has-beens shouldn't present fucking awards to Gunna Be.
Leave Billy alone!
By 1982, the now 24-year-old Michael Jackson was already one of the most promising pop stars on the planet. He had risen from a poor working-class family from Gary, Indiana, to a child prodigy alongside his brothers as part of the Jackson 5, scoring multiple number one records with the likes of ABC and Want You Back, just to name a few. Michael had also achieved solo success with a US number one single titled Ben, and achieved a US top three solo album with Off the Wall, which had sold 7 million copies at the time and spawned killer number one singles like Don't Stop Till You Get Enough and Rock With You. However, after only winning one Grammy for his single Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Michael felt underappreciated by the industry, as he believed Off the Wall deserved to win the Grammy for Album of the Year. Feeling snubbed, this only pushed the perfectionist that was Michael Jackson harder, as Michael, believing in the power of manifesting your dreams into reality, wrote famously on his Havenhurst bathroom mirror, quote, "Biggest selling album of all time," as he would look at himself in the mirror and recite this over and over. Michael was now determined, with every fibre in his body, to make his next solo album hit number one in America, and he wanted every single track on it to be good enough to stand on its own as a single. Michael started work on his sixth studio album, originally titled Starlight, and later famously being called Thriller, in April 1982 at Westlake Studios in Los Angeles, alongside Off the Wall producer Quincy Jones, who Michael had met on the set of the film The Wiz. Epic Records allocated a massive $750,000 budget for the project, showing that they had a lot of faith in Michael. However, it was at his family home in Havenhurst where Michael would lay down the demo for what would be the classic hit song, Billie Jean. As Michael wrote in Moonwalk, quote, "A musician knows hit material. It has to feel right. Everything has to feel in place. It fulfills you and makes you feel good. You know it when you hear it. That's how I felt about Billie Jean. I knew it was going to be big while I was writing it. I was really absorbed in that song." Michael claimed that when coming up with the rhythm and melody for the track, that he couldn't get the beat out of his head, and that he was so consumed with it that while on a break from the recording studio, during a drive with his trusted assistant Nelson Hayes along the Ventura Freeway, that he chucked on a rough demo of the track and began thinking of ways to improve it. The pair were so invested in the song that they were shocked to notice when a young man on a motorcycle had rode up beside them, tapping on the glass to tell them their Rolls-Royce was on fire. As they looked towards the front of the car, they noticed smoke billowing out, and when they pulled up, the whole bottom of the car was engulfed in flames. It was a near miss for the rising king of pop, who didn't realise the severity of the situation until much later on, realising that it could have blown them up. Funnily enough, Michael claimed that as he waited for an alternative ride, he continued to beatbox the beat and structure the song in his mind. Despite being a dream duo in the recording studio, during the recording and production process for Billie Jean, Michael and Quincy Jones butted heads on a number of occasions. Quincy wasn't a fan of the demo version that Michael had provided, and he disliked the bass line and thought the 29-second introduction was far too long and needed to be cut shorter, as Quincy believed that radio DJs wouldn't play it as it took too long to get to the vocals. Michael protested this, however, and with a smile on his face, he claimed it made him feel like dancing, as he said the famous line, quote, "But Quincy, that's the jelly. That's what makes me want to dance." And so the intro remained, as Quincy told the Radio Times, quote, "The intro to Billie Jean was so long you could shave during it. I said we had to get to the melody sooner, but Michael said that was what made him want to dance. And when Michael Jackson says something makes him want to dance, you don't argue. So he won." Quincy also disliked the title of the song, as he thought it sounded like Michael was referring to the female tennis great Billie Jean King, and put forward the title, Not My Lover. However, again, MJ won out. The pair also clashed and had a brief falling out over royalties, as Michael felt that Quincy hadn't altered his original home demo much. Because of this, Michael felt he deserved a co-production credit alongside Quincy, but Quincy rejected the proposal and won this battle. Under Quincy's direction, audio engineer for Billie Jean, Bruce Swedeen, got creative and had Michael sing overdubs of the lyric Don't Think Twice, using a 6-foot cardboard tube to create a special vocal effect, simulating that Michael was singing from far away, as Michael recorded these overdubs in just one incredible take, while his lead vocals were recorded across 3 takes. It was during these vocal recordings that Michael locked down his trademark vocal signatures that remained consistent throughout his career. Throughout Billie Jean, the track is scattered with Michael's trademark owls, his rhythmic gasps, and those famous high-pitched hee-hees. To the casual listener, these sound like spontaneous or strange bursts of energy, but in reality, Michael would use his voice as a literal percussion instrument. Every single owl or hee-hee was carefully placed to fall right in line with the drum beat. For Michael, it wasn't just singing, it was vocal choreography. All instruments used on Billie Jean were played in accordance with Michael's vision, as he beatboxed the rhythm he wanted for the guitar and drums to the session musicians, who followed his commands. Swedeen also put together a classical string section to give the song a more theatrical or classical feel, utilizing violin, cello, and viola. The iconic drum pattern was also recorded on top of a wooden platform that Swedeen had constructed, while a flat piece of wood was also placed between the snare and hi-hat, creating the unique but iconic punchy drum rhythm heard throughout the song. As Swedeen said, quote, "There aren't many pieces of music where you can hear the first three or four notes of the drums and immediately tell what piece of music it is. But I think that this is the case with Billie Jean, and that I attribute to sonic personality." Jazz saxophone player Tom Scott was also brought in to play the unique instrument, the lyricon, which is a quirky-sounding electronic wind instrument and synthesizer which accompanies the bass and drum pattern. Swedeen would be famously remembered for mixing the song a total of 91 times, with each mix becoming progressively worse, perhaps overthinking it. Quincy would be the one to tell him to play the second mix once again, which would eventually go down as the one we hear today. But while Michael claimed that the beat came to him in a vision on the freeway, two legendary musical forces claimed he actually lifted it from them, and the proof is hard to deny. First came Daryl Hall of Hall & Oates, who claimed that during a 1985 charity gala, Michael walked right up to him and apologized, stating, quote, "Hey man, I hope you don't mind, but I copied the groove from I Can't Go For That for my song Billie Jean." Luckily for Michael, Daryl couldn't care less, telling Michael, quote, "Oh Michael, what do I care? You did it very differently. We all do it." Producer Quincy Jones, however, was much more cynical as he noticed a striking similarity to Donna Summer's State of Independence, a track that Michael had actually sung backing vocals on just months earlier. While the public couldn't hear the resemblance at first, audio engineers later proved Quincy's theory. If you take Donna Summer's track and slow the pitch down by nearly 30%, the hidden blueprint of the Billie Jean bassline and note progression appears plain as day. As Quincy famously said, the notes don't lie. State of Independence songwriter John Anderson, however, didn't have a problem with it, stating, quote, "They took the riff and made it funky for Billie Jean, so that's kind of cool, that cross-pollination in music." Whether it was a deliberate lift or a subconscious rhythm that Michael couldn't get out of his head, it ultimately shows the unique nature of Michael's genius. He didn't just steal, he absorbed the music around him and mutated it into his own unique masterpiece. Michael, however, would never confirm or deny these claims. On the 18th of October 1982, the first song recorded and released from the Thriller studio sessions was the cheesy ballad "The Girl Is Mine," a duet featuring former Beatle Paul McCartney. While it was a commercial success, reaching number one on the US R&B chart and number two on the US Hot 100, it would receive mixed reviews, as critics labelled it the album's weakest track, a poor choice for an opening single, and many felt it leaned too hard into appealing to a white audience, while alienating Michael's black fanbase at the same time. For Michael, however, as he explained in his 1988 autobiography, Moonwalk, as Paul was such a big star, he wanted to get this song out of the way first, as he was worried about overexposure. As the music industry faced a massive economic recession in 1982, Epic Records was under an intense financial strain. The stakes now couldn't have been higher, and the label placed immense pressure on Michael to deliver. Both Quincy Jones and Michael worked themselves to the bone, often falling asleep right at the mixing desk, while Michael hardly ever saw his family. However, Michael was his own harshest critic. When they listened to the final playback of the album, Michael was devastated by the final mix, describing it as, quote, crappy, as he admitted to being on the verge of tears. Infuriated and angry, Michael demanded they cancel the release and stormed out of the studio, as he later wrote in his autobiography, quote, it's like taking a great movie and ruining it in the edit. To let off some steam, Michael picked up a bicycle belonging to Quincy's daughter and rode down the street, stopping by a nearby playground where he watched as kids laughed and played. Instantly, it put everything back into perspective. He realized he was making this album for kids just like them all over the world, dreaming of uniting humanity through music, no matter their skin color. Feeling inspired, Michael rode back to the studio with a fresh outlook. He hated the feeling of being rushed and essentially told his team not to give in to CBS's pushy ways, insisting that perfection takes time. After the team took 3 days off to clear their heads, they returned fresh to the studio and began a frantic race against the clock, mixing the whole album again from scratch at a rate of around 2 songs per week, reshaping music history in the process. With Michael happy with the final mix, the Thriller album was set to be released later on between Christmas 1982 and early January 1983. However, an unprecedented leak to radio stations forced the album's early release on the 29th of November 1982. Album sales were initially steady, however the lukewarm reception from the lead single The Girl Is Mine struggled to gain mass interest. Almost a month after its release, on Christmas Day 1982, Thriller debuted at number 11 on the US Billboard 200 before climbing into the top 5 thanks to the release of Billie Jean. Billie Jean was officially released on the 2nd of January 1983 as the post-disco, dance-pop and R&B track debuted around 20 days later at number 47 on the US Billboard Hottest 100, while it also reached number 1 on the US R&B Singles Chart 3 weeks into its release, remaining there for 9 weeks. Thanks to physical record sales and mass radio airplay across all different stations in America, Billie Jean would peak at number 1 on the Billboard Hottest 100 by March 5, 1983, remaining there for 7 weeks, as it became Michael's biggest solo hit to date and his fastest rising number 1 single since his days with the Jackson 5. Not only did Billie Jean conquer the American charts, but it also had a massive global reach, peaking at number 1 in 8 countries, including Australia, the UK, Canada, and Spain, while also making it to the top 5 in 7 other countries, including South Africa and New Zealand, cementing Michael as a force to be reckoned with all around the world. No matter where you went, you couldn't escape hearing the tragic tale of Billie Jean on the radio, that infectious shuffling beat or tragic melody, as the refreshing lyrics tell a unique story that really hadn't been delved into before in popular culture, surrounding the topics of paranoia, false allegations, and the cautionary tale to always be careful who you trust. Billie Jean's explosive success pushed the entire Thriller album to the number one spot on the Billboard 200 by late February 1983. But beneath the infectious post-disco groove and that unforgettable bassline lay a dark, paranoid reality. Many assume the song was about one specific woman attempting to trap the star, claiming he had fathered her child and was now denying any responsibility, as the lyrics read, "Billie Jean is not my lover, she's just a girl who claims that I am the one. But the kid is not my son." However, Michael later revealed a different perspective. In his 1988 autobiography Moonwalk, Michael claimed the song came to him through God and stated that the track was inspired by a combination of groupies and obsessed fans that he observed his brothers fall victim to, as he stated, quote, "There never was a real Billie Jean. The girl in the song is a composite of people my brothers have been plagued with over the years." However, he also gave a somewhat conflicting statement in different interviews, claiming in one that the song was, quote, "really personal," while in another interview in Thailand, he said, quote, "There is a girl named Billie Jean, but it's not about that Billie Jean. Billie Jean is kind of anonymous. It represents a lot of girls. They used to call them groupies in the 60s. They would hang around backstage doors, and any band that would come to town, they would have a relationship with. And I think I wrote this out of experience with my brothers when I was little. There were a lot of Billie Jeans out there. Every girl claimed that their son was related to one of my brothers. These women would frequently lurk around the family's compound at Havenhurst Estate in Encino, California, and bordered on stalker-like behaviour, with some scaling the walls or breaching security and attempting to enter the house. As Michael's older brothers, Jackie and Jermaine, who were hits with the ladies back in the Jackson 5 days, were said to have often received paternity tests sent to them via mail, along with love letters and panties. As Jermaine claimed in his book called Michael, that he was once sent pink baby shoes by a woman who claimed he was the father of her unborn child, stating, quote, "These are for the baby we will be having. I am pregnant with your child." While this spooked the brothers, they knew they practiced safe sex, so it was nearly impossible. While Jermaine claimed that any allegations made towards Michael were impossible as he didn't sleep with fans. Michael himself was no stranger to this lifestyle. It was all he had known since his early childhood. While Michael loved his fans dearly and enjoyed being a star, when he was younger, as Jackson 5 mania was in full swing, he hated being clawed at, pushed down, and pulled in opposite directions by screaming and obsessed fans, who unintentionally would take things too far. To ensure the brothers' safety, the Jackson 5 security team would often set out plans to exit a building should the crowd turn raving mad and storm the stage, which on plenty of occasions they did, even chasing them through corridors and surrounding their vehicles, to the point where Michael couldn't even see out of the limousine any longer as the mass of bodies covered the windows. While the Jackson 5 were also followed to hotels, airports, and malls, yelling things like, "I want to have your babies," or "marry me." With the lyrics to Billie Jean seeming deeply personal, many began to speculate if there was in fact a real Billie Jean. Michael would hint at this being somewhat true, as he claimed in his book Moonwalk, that Billie Jean was never about someone real, except for the ones that came after. As he would mostly remain tight-lipped on this subject, which played into the song's lore. Michael also said in this book, quote, "I couldn't understand how these girls could say they were carrying someone's child when it wasn't true. I can't imagine lying about something like that. Even today, there are girls that come to our house and say the strangest things, like I'm Michael's wife, or I'm just dropping off the keys to our apartment." Michael went on to claim that some even said Jesus or God sent them to speak to him, and that it was often frightening and disturbing, as scuffles between these women and security guards often broke out at the Havenhurst gates. According to music biographer J. Randy Tarabarelli's 1991 book The Magic and the Madness, Michael was hiding a much darker, terrifying reality that had been happening right outside the gates of his family's Havenhurst compound. While it was never confirmed by Michael Jackson himself, Tarabarelli claimed that during 1981, Michael and his family started receiving strange and unsettling letters from an anonymous woman who claimed that Michael was the biological father of one of her two twins. Often receiving fan love letters by the truckload, Michael chose to ignore it. However, the frequency that these letters were being sent from this anonymous source had increased significantly and became increasingly disturbing, as the woman professed her love for Michael, that she wanted to marry him, and attempted to guilt him, stating, "How could you ignore your own child, or your, quote, own flesh and blood?" Then, when Michael received a strange package inside the gates of Havenhurst, Michael's mother Catherine was said to be present at the time when the package was opened, revealing inside that there was a loaded handgun with a photograph of the woman and yet another letter containing a mutual suicide pact, stating that Michael needed to shoot himself using the gun at a specific time on a specific day, and that she would then kill their so-called child, followed by herself, so they could all be together in the afterlife. It's said that this dark incident shook Michael to his core, as he suffered from severe nightmares and paranoia afterwards, and was concerned the woman would come after him, or worse, harm her own child. Luckily, however, she was said to have been sent to a psychiatric unit, although, in a chilling twist, Michael was said to have kept the photograph of the stalker and framed it, placing it on the dining room wall for the whole family to see. His mother Catherine was said to have been disturbed by this, but Michael insisted it was so he didn't forget what she looked like if she ever did turn up one day. Jerry Hershey of Rolling Stone magazine would back up this claim by Tarabarelli when, during an interview at Havenhurst, he also noticed the frame photo alongside a letter from the so-called real-life Billie Jean. Hershey claimed that the girl appeared to be a black teenager posing for a high school yearbook. While Quincy Jones and Bruce Swedeen claimed that this same woman, much to Michael's surprise, was seen sitting by his family pool at Havenhurst in a bathing suit and sunglasses, after scaling the wall, only to be taken away by security, as she was said to have told them, Michael is the father of one of her twins. It's believed that due to the danger posed by this stalker and the possibility of encouraging copycats, Michael would never publicly reveal the song's true origins, choosing to instead go with the tame story involving his brothers. The cultural obsession with Billie Jean's backstory was so massive that it even triggered a bizarre musical trend with Answer Records. In late 1983, an American singer named Lydia Murdoch scored a global hit with an Answer record titled Superstar. Singing over a near-identical rhythm track, Murdoch took on the literal role of Billie Jean, firing directly back at Michael with the lyrics, "I'm Billie Jean, and I'm mad as hell. I'm a woman with a story to tell." It was a hit song that openly accused the pop star of dodging his responsibilities. On the 10th of March 1983, MTV aired the world premiere of the Billie Jean music video, or short film, as Michael preferred to call them. There has always been a fierce debate over what it actually cost to make the video. In his autobiography Moonwalk, Michael recalled a massive $250,000 budget being allocated by CBS. However, director Steve Barron remembers a much harsher reality of a budget of just $50,000. With that tight budget, it forced the crew to get creative. Barron, who was chosen by Michael for his innovative and unique perspective, originally envisioned a whole troupe of dancers trailing behind Michael, but funding forced them to scrap this idea, leading instead to the iconic concept of Michael possessing a magical, glowing Midas touch. Because they couldn't even afford the automatic pressure pads to make the pavement stones light up, the crew had to manually flip switches as Michael danced, relying entirely on his razor-sharp precision to hit the right tiles at the right exact moment. Director Steve Barron fought the label to shoot the music video on cinematic 35mm film instead of the industry standard videotape, a decision that Michael backed. Michael was determined to become a true pioneer in the music video industry and wanted to leave a permanent mark. He wanted to completely eliminate the era of boring half-baked videos of bands simply singing into a microphone, and instead had the vision of gluing audiences to their TV screens by introducing cinematic storylines with a beginning, middle, and an ending, which perfectly match the narrative of the song. The Billie Jean short film would be a cinematic masterpiece for the time, featuring Michael dancing down the street as his magic Midas touch shoes light up the pavement as he makes his way to Billie Jean's bed, only for the pesky paparazzi to unsuccessfully attempt to catch him on camera, as Michael's magic helps him evade them. According to Barron, when they finished shooting the video, he said, quote, "We shot that first take, got to the end, and everyone, up in the gantries, eating their sandwiches, reading the paper, painters working on another set, just burst into applause. We all just knew we'd seen another era of superstar." With Billie Jean, Michael would redefine what a music video should look like, bringing his grand vision to life, as this clip, along with Beat It and Thriller, would set the precedent for the entire music industry to follow. But behind the scenes, getting this video on the air was no easy task. Despite Michael being the hottest rising artist on the planet, initially MTV flat out rejected the video for Billie Jean, and apart from playing Pass the Duchy by novelty British reggae group Musical Youth, MTV had only ever exclusively played white rock and pop acts like Duran Duran, Bruce Springsteen, and Van Halen, since the channel's debut on the 1st of August 1981 with the inaugural music video, Video Killed the Radio Star. MTV executives, including network CEO Les Garland, claimed that their audience simply wasn't interested in R&B or urban music, which was their sugar-coated way of saying they didn't want to play serious black artists on their programs. While there was also a stigma around that black artists made poor quality music videos. However, this was actually caused by MTV's stance, as record companies often chose not to fund their production as they knew they wouldn't get airtime anyway. MTV executives also made the excuse that they preferred to wait to play Beat It first, as it featured rocker Eddie Van Halen on guitar, and suited their station's target audience, as Bob Pittman, co-founder of MTV, said, quote, "We are looking for a certain sound with a certain point of view." This came after black glam rocker Rick James called out MTV for being racist after his music video for the hit song Super Freak was denied also. While fellow artists like Prince and Lionel Richie were also overlooked. David Bowie, however, went to bat for the black community, stating that MTV were, quote, "scared to death by artists like Prince." When CBS Records president Walter Yetnikov learnt that his big-name artist Michael Jackson was being rejected by MTV, he was having none of it and was furious, with Yetnikov handing MTV a brutal ultimatum, threatening to pull every single CBS artist from the network if they didn't play Billie Jean. As he stated, quote, "I said to MTV, I'm pulling everything we have off the air, all our product. I'm not going to give you any more videos. And I'm going to go public and fucking tell them about the fact you don't want to play music by a black guy." With MTV facing the possibility of losing access to big-name CBS stars like Springsteen, Billy Joel, and Men at Work, and being faced with total ruin and a massive public relations disaster if they didn't back down, MTV gave in and handed Billie Jean not only its debut, but placed it on heavy rotation. The music video wouldn't just perform well, it exploded, shattering MTV's racial colour barrier forever, paving the way for fellow black artists to be seen, and forcing the network to evolve from a niche white rock channel into a global cultural giant. Viewers absolutely loved the video, as it helped sustain Billie Jean at the top of the charts for several weeks, and along with Beat It, Billie Jean featured heavily on a two-month rotation during the summer of 83, with Thriller, of course, coming along soon after and totally revolutionising the whole music video industry. Much later in 1992, the Billie Jean music video would be inducted into the Music Video Producers Hall of Fame. It was around the time of the music video's release in March 1983, where Michael was approached by his former label Motown Records to perform a dance routine and a medley alongside his brothers as part of the Jackson 5 at the upcoming Motown 25 Yesterday, Today, Forever TV special, which was set to air on NBC in less than 2 months' time, and would celebrate Motown's 25th anniversary. The Jacksons were set to reform, with Jackie, Tito, Marlon, Randy, and even the returning Jermaine. However, despite the efforts of Motown, Jermaine, and Michael's mother Catherine to have Michael reunite with his brothers on stage, Michael just wasn't interested, and feared it would be a backward step in his career, with his team informing him to focus on building his own solo career and releasing the remainder of his singles from his current album Thriller. The Jacksons would instead prepare to take to the stage without their frontman. That was until Motown Records founder Berry Gordy got on the phone and spoke to Michael, interrupting him during a mixing session for Beat It by telling him that the Jackson 5 just wouldn't be the same without him fronting the band, as his good friend and mentor Diana Ross was also set to return with the Supremes, while Smokey Robinson was set to reunite with the Miracles. Michael respected Gordy and would agree under one condition. After he performed a medley alongside his brothers, he wanted a solo slot to showcase his latest hit song, Billie Jean. Surprisingly, Gordy would happily agree to Michael's terms, as Billie Jean would become the first and only non-Motown song to be performed on their stage. Michael would treat the performance like just another day at the office, and on the night before the show, Michael found himself casually walking through his steps in the kitchen of the family's Havenhurst estate, with his dance routine said to be inspired by Bob Fosse's 1974 musical appearance in The Little Prince, with bent knees, jazz hands, and hip thrusts, along with loads of improvisation, as Michael loved to feel out the song and dance to the rhythm. It was here in the kitchen, the night before the show, that he decided he would debut a dance move he had spent the last 2 years perfecting, which was a backward gliding illusion that he liked to call the moonwalk. Now, the origin of how Michael learned this move is a subject of legendary debate. In his 1988 autobiography, Michael claimed he didn't invent the move, but that he picked up the premise for it straight from the streets of Harlem, after watching three young African-American street dancers from the ghettos pulling off the impossible move before adapting and enhancing the move himself and perfecting it over 2 years' time. But behind the secure gates of Havenhurst, the truth was much more calculated. Michael was a perfectionist who studied his craft like a science. In 1981, after observing Jeffrey Daniel pull off a street version of the move called the backslide on the TV show Soul Train, Michael was amazed and immediately had his management track him down to teach him the move. As Jeffrey Daniel was out of the country on tour, he sent out fellow Soul Train dancers, Derek Cooley Jackson and Garon Casbah Candidate, to give him a week of intense, private lessons at Havenhurst, so he could master the weight-shifting mechanics of the slide. Michael took that raw street technique, which had actually been evolving since the early 1930s, and combined it with his own theatrical flair, practicing on his kitchen floor as he transformed the move into a piece of pure stage magic. Now, with his brand new and improved dance move ready to go, Michael just needed one more thing and had his team order him a black fedora with a, quote, sinister slouch, as he wanted to go for a secret agent or spy-type appearance and saved it for his Billie Jean performance. And now, he was finally ready to show the world and blow their mind, but little did he know, he was about to become the biggest star on the planet. It was March 25th, 1983. The Pasadena Civic Auditorium is packed to the rafters, with Hollywood royalty and Motown legends in the building, as Michael makes his way onto stage with his brothers, dressed in his now iconic black high-water trousers, leather penny loafer shoes, white socks, his singular sparkling white rhinestone glove, and of course, his shiny sequin jacket that was famously pulled from his mother's wardrobe, as Michael loved the fit and the way it shined under the lights. As the Jacksons wrapped up a high-energy nostalgic medley, performing all the hits from I Want You Back to a heartwarming rendition of I'll Be There, they would receive a standing ovation for their performance. After taking a bow and giving Michael a hug, his brothers exit the stage, leaving Michael solitary, as the mood in the room abruptly shifts. A breathless Michael paces the stage before speaking to the audience, stating, quote, "Thank you, you're beautiful. You know, I have to say, those were the good old days. I love those songs. Those were magic moments with all my brothers, including Jermaine. But, those were good songs. I like those songs a lot. But especially, I like..." Michael pauses as the crowd screams and chants, "Billie Jean! before Michael replies, with a cheeky confidence, the new songs. Instantly, the crowd erupts into screams and cheers as a spotlight beams down onto Michael. He fluently grips a black fedora, spins into position, and places it on his head before starting to thrust and grab at his crutch to the hypnotic beat of Billie Jean as that iconic bass line and drum fill thumps through the auditorium. Michael's moves are like no other, improvising with some Bruce Lee-inspired kicks before tossing his fedora to the side of stage, grabbing the mic and blowing the audience's socks off with his incredible vocals, gravity-defying moves, and angry snarls towards the camera. It's like nothing anyone's ever seen before, as Michael begins to move with an almost superhuman precision. It was out of this world. Every snap of his fingers, every pop of his shoulder, every shuffle of his feet, perfectly synchronized with the punchy drum track and clucky guitar riff. He is completely in his element and has the whole room captivated under his spell, as they ride every epic moment with him. But the real magic trick is yet to come. Billie Jean builds to its bridge as Michael lets out his iconic shrieks and points, looks left, then right, and with effortless grace, Michael plants his left foot and begins to glide backwards on his right. It defies the laws of physics. To the people in the room, it looks like a visual illusion, like he could walk on water, as he spins and drops into a tight, breathless freeze on the tips of his toes, as the crowd goes absolutely nuts. They can't believe what they have just witnessed, as they stand in shock, giving Michael a massive standing ovation, some going as far as standing on their own chairs to applaud. According to Jermaine, he and his brothers were said to have been watching the performance from the wings of the stage as all of their jaws dropped to the floor in amazement at Michael's dance moves, while Michael's parents Joseph and Catherine Jackson were amongst the audience watching on. As Michael wrote in his book Moonwalk, quote, "I just remember opening my eyes at the end of the thing and seeing a sea of people standing up applauding, and I felt so many conflicting emotions. I knew I had done my best and felt good, so good, but at the same time, I felt disappointed in myself." Being the perfectionist that he is, Michael claimed in his autobiography that when he got backstage, despite his brothers embracing him, he felt like he had failed. After attempting to land on his toes and stay suspended on them following the moonwalk and spin. As Michael claimed that he failed to hold it for as long as he would have liked to, and also landed on just the one toe, causing him to lose balance. Other than a slight grimace on Michael's face in that moment, it was a minor detail that really no one else had noticed. However, an interaction with a 10-year-old boy backstage changed Michael's opinion on his own performance, when the boy stopped in his tracks, awestruck that he was now standing in front of Michael Jackson. As the boy said, "Man, whoever taught you to dance like that?" As Michael laughed and replied, "Practice, I guess." Michael walked out of the building that night feeling proud of his efforts and glad he accepted the invitation after all, as he knows children are honest and great judges of talent. On the 16th of May 1983, Michael's Motown 25 performance would air on the NBC, sending the country into meltdown, as close to 47 million viewers tuned in, only to be blown away by Michael's performance of Billie Jean, which of course stole the show and would go down as one of music and TV's greatest moments. In just seconds of this choreographic genius, Michael hadn't just debuted the moonwalk to the world, he would go down in the history books, and with this performance and the Thriller album, he would cement his transition from a childhood star to the undisputed King of Pop. From this performance, Michael would earn an Emmy Award nomination, and despite not winning it, he claimed he didn't even care, as some of his idols that he grew up admiring had contacted him after the show had aired to congratulate him, with Fred Astaire reaching out, claiming, quote, "You're a hell of a mover, you really put them on their asses last night," before claiming that Michael was an angry dancer, just like him. Astaire loved the performance so much that he even taped it and watched it back a second time the following morning. While Astaire even invited Michael out to his place to teach him how to do the moonwalk. After the Motown 25 performance and music video had aired, Michael Jackson was the name on everyone's lips. If you remembered the first time that man stepped on the moon, then you certainly remembered where you were when you witnessed Michael moonwalk for the first time. Michael had even set off a fashion trend with kids and teenagers all over the world, as they would imitate his black leather suit, pink shirt, and red bow tie from his music video, and Michael's iconic look from the Motown 25 performance, including the singular white glove and fedora, all while impersonating his dance move, the moonwalk. The craze had gotten so big that one school from New Jersey called Boundbrook High School even made national news when they banned students from wearing Michael Jackson-inspired white gloves and performing the moonwalk, as it had become a massive distraction from their schoolwork. Despite student protests claiming it was a right of free expression, the school board won out, and the glove in particular was banned. Michael had even started a hairstyle trend with the Jerry Curl, a hairstyle that requires loads of hairspray, as it was said to have become a problem in schools as it was highly flammable. Michael also helped revive the once outdated look of bright white socks and high water trousers that once saw him be teased by his brothers for being a quote, dip or goofball. Michael had specifically chosen this style for Motown 25 to create a sharp visual contrast, ensuring that his rapid footwork wouldn't get lost on the dark stage. In doing so, he proved he was not only an entertainment powerhouse, but a true fashion icon and trendsetter. It was around this time that Michael and his manager, Frank DeLeo, engineered a brilliant, highly calculated masterstroke, releasing the next single, Beat It, while Billie Jean held down the number one spot. Despite intense fears from CBS Records that Beat It would cannibalize and kill the momentum of Billie Jean, the gamble would result in an unprecedented display of chart dominance. The two tracks would climb to the absolute top of the Billboard Hottest 100 together. For three consecutive weeks, Michael did the unthinkable, holding down the number one and number two spots in America simultaneously. It was a historic lockdown of the airwaves that reached a fever pitch on April 30th, 1983, when Beat It finally knocked Billie Jean out of the top spot to claim number one for itself. During this golden period for Michael Jackson, the explosive popularity of Billie Jean helped pick up sales for the Thriller album by as many as 1 million copies per week at its peak, completely shattering any initial industry fears that Michael's career was stalling. Armed with a succession of smash hits like Wannabe Startin' Somethin', Human Nature, and of course Thriller, alongside their masterpiece short films, the Thriller album would go on to rule the US charts at number one for a record-breaking 37 weeks, while also breaking the record as the first album and single to go to number one simultaneously in the US. To this day, it remains the highest-selling album of all time, with estimated global sales between 70 and 100 million copies. The era would wrap up with Michael winning a record-breaking 8 Grammy Awards in a single night, a monumentous milestone that would stand completely unmatched until Santana tied the record in the year 2000. Two of these golden gramophones belong solely to Billie Jean itself, taking home Best R&B Song and Male R&B Vocal Performance. While Michael also won a record 8 AMAs in 1984 for his work on Thriller, a record shared only with Whitney Houston, as Billie Jean won Favorite Pop Rock Single. Billie Jean's cultural dominance would also lead to corporate giants looking to get a piece of the pie. In early 1984, the Pepsi Cola Company paid Michael a record-breaking $5 million to star in a massive ad campaign, where he rewrote the lyrics of Billie Jean into a commercial anthem for the new generation. It was a legendary partnership that would unfortunately result in the infamous, tragic pyrotechnic accident that changed Michael's life forever. On the sixth take of the shoot, a catastrophic timing error caused Michael's hair to catch fire after an explosion from a magnesium flare rained down on his head. Michael's scalp was covered in the highly flammable chemical activators or hairspray required for his famous Jerry Curl hairstyle, causing his hair to instantly catch fire. Had he not spun vigorously, putting the spark out, it could have been deadly. Michael was left with severe second and third degree burns, resulting in chronic, agonizing pain that he would battle throughout the remainder of his career. To compensate for this disaster, Pepsi settled out of court for $1.5 million. True to his character, Michael donated every single cent of the proceeds to the Brotman Medical Center Burns Unit in Culver City, California, that very same unit that had taken care of him. While Thriller was rising to absolutely insane heights and Michael joined his brothers on the Victory Tour, the universe was preparing a cruel twist of irony for Michael. Just when he thought he could leave the dark, paranoid inspiration for Billie Jean safely in his past, his worst nightmare manifested into reality. To protect the family from an influx of obsessed fans, the security team at Havenhurst Estate had to maintain a literal wall of sketches and photographs of dangerous stalkers to avoid, known as the Billie Jeans. However, one particular woman would break through every boundary and would seamlessly slip through the cracks on a consistent basis. Enter a woman named LaVon Powlis, a deeply delusional fan who stepped out of the shadows and began launching a relentless campaign against the superstar, which would essentially last for the remainder of Michael's career and even beyond his death. As Powlis would aggressively accuse Michael of writing the song Billie Jean about her, later claiming in a 1980s interview that Michael was even speaking in code to her during the song, sending her secret messages that only they'd know about. As she said, quote, "Billie Jean is not my lover" means he is my lover. For Michael, it was a terrifying case of life imitating art, and the initial fear he held for copycat stalkers to emerge was now a reality. Just as the lyrics in Billie Jean suggest, be careful what you do, because a lie becomes the truth. In truth, Michael had been dealing with this particular stalker since 1981. However, it wasn't until 1987 when the nightmare became public knowledge. Known as a pesky loiterer outside the Havenhurst gates, Powlis had already been sentenced to 36 months probation in May 1986 for trespassing twice. Powlis broke that probation almost immediately, being sent to jail for 52 days and given 2 years probation in September 1986. However, after her release, she would only keep away for a few months. By August of 1987, Her delusion turned into financial harassment. She went to a luxury bridal boutique, tried on a wedding dress worth over $1,000, and attempted to bill the unsuccessful purchase directly to Michael. She even sent him bills for everyday clothes that she intended to purchase at his expense, and had previously tried to force Michael for an $145 medical bill in December 1986. The nightmare would blow wide open on August 14, 1987, right as the 28-year-old Michael was preparing to release Bad, his follow-up album to Thriller. The 39-year-old, unemployed Lavon Powless, who claimed to be a former legal secretary, stepped into the spotlight by self-representing and filing a massive $150 million paternity lawsuit in the Cook County Court in Illinois. Powless was so consumed by the delusion that she even had her name legally changed to Billie Jean Jackson, and told the courtroom that they had shared a 6-year-long relationship after first meeting in New York, before Michael had invited her to LA, as she declared that Michael was the secret father of her 3 children, including her 11-year-old son and her 5-year-old male and female twins, as Powless claimed that they had conceived their children on the 5th of May 1975 and the twins on the 4th of July 1981, while parked right outside the Havenhurst gates inside a blue Rolls Royce. If you do the quick math on that alleged 1975 hookup, Powless's story completely falls apart. In May of 1975, Michael was only a 16-year-old minor, while Powless was a 27-year-old adult. Not only is that timeline far-fetched, but what she was describing would have been completely illegal and implicated herself. But the logic flaws didn't stop there. Powless claimed that Michael had proposed to her on the 13th of September 1985. However, due to, quote, family feuds on Michael's side, the wedding had been delayed. During this time, Powless would even conduct TV and magazine interviews to get her story out there, completely believing in her own delusions. Lavon Powless revealed in a telephone interview, quote, Michael is the father. Michael got me pregnant, and I want Michael to pay for it. I want his name for the children, plus $50 million per child. I need some money, and I want some money for my children. I had always been in love with him, and I wanted to meet him. He invited me out to LA. Michael asked me to marry him September 13th, 1985. I said yes, of course. Now, if you look up this case online today, you'll probably run into a pretty wild piece of 80s internet lore. For years, people have claimed that her courtroom demands didn't just stop at cash. The rumour is that she actually asked the judge to grant her custody of Michael's pet chimpanzee, Bubbles, along with 3 cases of Pepsi Cola. Now, as crazy as that sounds, it's more than likely just classic 80s tabloid gossip, sensationalising a bizarre case even further. But the real story, however, was far more serious and dangerous. Michael's publicist, Lee Salters, would call the claims, quote, ridiculous and preposterous, while according to the Washington Post, a spokesperson for the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, named David Snyderman, claimed Powless had made similar claims about 3 other high-profile celebrities in the past, as he said, quote, she is famous for claiming that various famous people are the father of her children. If this lady doesn't know who the father is, we don't. While Snyderman also claimed that they had taken custody of the children and placed them back in the care of family living in New York, after 2 of the children were found to be left alone outside of a black Muslim mosque in Chicago. In the end, the judge would throw the case out of court as Powerless possessed absolutely zero biological evidence to suggest Michael was her children's biological father, while a restraining order would also be put into place, lasting up to the year 1990. Just as Michael thought it would be all said and done, however, the restraining order did nothing to stop her, as she would turn to trespassing and further stalking. In 1988, Powerless would be arrested and later plead innocent to 8 misdemeanor charges after scaling the 5-foot-high security fence at Havenhurst at 3 in the morning with a bottle of champagne in hand. In court, the judge realized she was completely detached from reality and offered her a lighter sentence if she agreed to a mental health evaluation. Powerless, however, refused, claiming she was entirely sane, and firing back at the judge, stating, quote, "I don't require mental health care, sir." Left with no choice, the judge sentenced her to 2.5 years in prison. In an incredible twist, the judge actually made reference to the lyrics of Michael's newly released song at the time, "Leave Me Alone," during the sentencing, as he said, quote, "So just leave me alone, girl. Just stop dogging me, girl." As the judge looked over at Powerless and directly stated, "You listen to the chorus of that song, and you listen to those words." Jermaine even recalls a story about Powerless in his autobiography, Michael, claiming that Powerless showed up at the gates of Havenhurst with all 3 children, having completely shaved off their hair. When Michael's mother, Catherine, approached to talk to her, Powerless claimed that she did it because they had lice, boldly demanding that Catherine as their grandmother and Michael as their father start paying up to help take care of them. Throughout the 90s, not even jail time could deter Powerless, as the obsession only intensified. Operating under various aliases like Lavon Muhammad and Gabriella Jamila Jackson, she again trespassed and began court proceedings in October 1995. This time, she was sentenced to 99 days in jail. Once out, however, she continually tried to breach security, scaling the walls of Havenhurst and even pacing the gates of Neverland Ranch. But her most bold attempt came when she legally changed her name to Billie Jean Jackson and went as far as securing a valid California driver's license, which listed her home address as Neverland Ranch, using the government-issued ID to breach the grounds of the estate. This led to yet another restraining order being put in place, stating that Powerless could not come within 100 yards of Michael, his properties, or his family. Michael's legal team was forced into a never-ending game of cat and mouse, constantly renewing restraining orders just to keep her away from his family, as she would be arrested a further 3 times in 1995 alone. Powerless would pop up sporadically over the years, but after a quiet spell, during late 2008, a huge escalation and retaliation by Powerless occurred just months before Michael's tragic passing. Now age 60, she claimed this time around that she was secretly married to Michael and that she was the mother of Michael's 6-year-old youngest son, B.G. Blanket Jackson, as she filed a new lawsuit demanding a staggering $1 billion in child support, a luxury mansion, and joint custody so she could visit B.G. on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, and have a say in where he was educated. When the judge requested what proof she had to show she was the mother, Powerless delivered a breathtakingly delusional statement to the court, as she stated, quote, "I'm the mother. Michael took him. If we took DNA tests, that would prove it. I'm the mother. I'm Michael's wife. There was a marriage on May 5th, 1986. I don't want to tell you in an open court about it because it sounds like a miracle. Michael sings to me on his album." She went on to claim that Michael, the police, and the Jackson family had actively threatened her and had her arrested. Once again, the courts dismissed this relentless harassment campaign when Powless failed to produce biological evidence that she was the boy's mother. In a chilling twist, the shadow of the real-life Billie Jean even lingered beyond Michael's death. In late 2009, she had been arrested for demanding to be let into Neverland after scaling the gates, before filing claims against the Michael Jackson estate, attempting to legally halt the release of the documentary film This Is It, while demanding her rights as his widow. The judge again denied her case and suggested she seek psychiatric help. It proved that no matter how many millions of albums Michael sold, or how high his stardom rose, he could never truly outrun the terrifying reality of Billie Jean that he had helped create. As for the whereabouts of LaVon Powless today, she has completely vanished from the headlines. Now approaching her late 70s, it's unclear whether she grew tired of the chase since Michael had passed away, whether she is living out her days quietly in institutional care, or if she has quietly passed away. Sadly, LaVon Powless wouldn't be the only one to pester Michael and his family all these years, as they would deal with death threats, kidnap or extortion threats in regards to Michael's children, and endless claims of secret pregnancies. In his memoir, Michael's brother Jermaine recalled another major stalker from across the Atlantic that targeted Michael. He detailed an anonymous woman from the UK who took her delusion to a terrifyingly official level, going as far as forging highly detailed British birth and marriage certificates to try and force the family to admit she was Michael's secret wife. However, the tale of LaVon Powless remains the ultimate blueprint of the warning Michael left for the world. Be careful what you do, because a lie becomes the truth. In the end, Billie Jean wouldn't just break records in 1983 alone. Instead, it would go on to have an influence on popular music forever, even surging back up the charts following his death, where it reached number 2 on the US Billboard Hot Digital Songs chart. Today, 43 years after its release, Billie Jean is still an absolute juggernaut and regarded as one of the greatest and most influential songs of all time, inspiring the likes of Pharrell Williams, Justin Timberlake, Kanye West, the 1975's Matty Healy, and The Weeknd, just to name a few. Most recently, Billie Jean has crossed the staggering milestone of over 2.8 billion streams on Spotify, and is climbing rapidly, with over 40 million streams in just 1 week during late May 2026, while its iconic music video sits comfortably with over 2.1 billion views on YouTube, and was actually the first video by a solo artist from the 1980s to reach 1 billion views on the platform. Thanks to the highly successful Michael biopic, released in 2026, Billie Jean topped the Daily Global Spotify chart as of May 15th, raking in over 6 million streams in just 24 hours, and breaking the record as the oldest song to ever reach the number one spot. But Billie Jean didn't stop there. It has since re-entered and climbed the Billboard Hottest 100 in the US at number 15, and continues to climb by the week, while it has also skyrocketed to number 1 on the Billboard Global 200, a chart built entirely for the modern streaming era. By taking that top spot, a 43-year-old track by an artist who passed away nearly 2 decades ago did the unthinkable, completely dethroning active streaming heavyweights like Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, and K-pop giants BTS. This historic surge has seen Michael reclaim his position as one of the most listened to artists on the planet, with his monthly listeners skyrocketing past 109 million as he continues to set records, even in death. With this, Billie Jean remains one of the most streamed tracks from the entire 20th century, proving that new generations are falling in love with that infectious bassline every single day, as the biopic introduces a whole new wave of fans to the undeniable excellence of the Thriller era and those unforgettable moments like the Motown 25 Moonwalk, reminding the world of the sheer genius that was Michael Jackson. Because despite the real-life stalkers, the courtroom chaos, and the heavy burden of fame, Michael took his deepest paranoias and turned them into a moody anthem that the world still can't stop dancing to, proving that long after the courtrooms cleared and the headlines had faded, that the genius of Michael Jackson is what stands the test of time and lives on today. Hey everyone, for those of you that made it this far, I wanted to throw in a quick surprise announcement as a massive thank you for listening. Coming soon to Lyrics of Their Life podcast is the epic story of the King of Pop himself, Michael Jackson. From his childhood in Gary, Indiana, to the massive scandals, the legendary music, and his untimely death, together, we are going to unpack this entire incredible story in a special multi-part series. I wanted to let you guys know first, and I hope you're just as excited as I am to get into this crazy story. Stay tuned, and again, thanks for listening. And that wraps up this episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast. Thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If this is your first time tuning into our show, don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss our future episodes. And if you're really enjoying the show, a quick rating or review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts goes a long way in helping us to grow. If you would like to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, X, and TikTok at Lyrics of Their Life Podcast, or on our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com for updates and more. If you'd like to support the podcast further and help keep episodes like this coming, you can head over to my Patreon at patreon.com/lyricsoftheirlifepodcast, or you can buy me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/lyricsoflifepod. Every bit of support means the world to me and helps make episodes like this one possible. Whether you're a long-time listener or just discovering the show for the first time, thank you for being here and supporting the show in whatever form that comes in. Thanks again for listening. I'm your host, Adam Hampton, and this is Lyrics of Their Life.